get a little bit over here. Our constant need to reach for the stars above you and me. Sister
Welcome to the roundtable and welcome to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It is the 19th of March, which, as Teresa was nice enough to point out, is
St. Joseph's Day.
That's
happy
right.
St. Joseph's
Thank you very
Day.
Much. Yes, the Feast of St. Joseph is today.
Honoring.
You know, Patrick Jesus. Gets all the. Takes out all the air in the room, but we have two or three listeners who always send me these incredible pictures on St. Joseph's Day of these Italian feasts that they have on St. Joseph's Day. My God, they look amazing. Just I got to take part in one of those at some point.
And it's Father's Day in some countries.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because he's the father, the Feast of the Father. It's honoring the father and family.
That's correct.
And people caring and supporting for each other. And there are these family meals. You're supposed to provide a meal for those who don't have a meal. And, it's quite a feast in some countries. And I went to St. Joseph's School when I was young and St. Joseph's Church until they closed it. I'm still sad about that.
I was married in St. Joseph's Church.
Oh, yeah.
So, yes. Yeah.
How appropriate. Anyway, so to all the Josephs and all the fathers and all those who care for each other, happy feast day.
And don't worry. We take the separation of church and state seriously. We won't go on our Catholicism after this, I promise.
And if I offended anyone just now.
No, not at all. I opened up my email this morning and I got an email that said, someone is impersonating Joe Donahue.
Impossible.
No.
You know, right? And
You are one of a kind.
So apparently people are going out there saying, if you want to be on the book show and give me some money and we'll get you on the show and that kind of stuff.
Oh,
and,
no.
So that's bad. So if you get one of those notes, know that that's a scam. But I was thinking to help the person impersonating me, first of all, you wake up with like this just vicious panic attack. And just be like shaking. Also, I'm still trying to pass the kidney stone, so my urine is the color of sangria.
Okay, that's TMI. I'm sorry. That is
so me. You know, if you want to do the impersonation right, that's ultimately how you do it. But, good morning, all. We have a lot to get to today, and I promise you we'll get to it. Tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, Dr. Ibram Kendi will be with us. He has a brand new book out. It came out Tuesday, and it is it's terrific, and it's called Chain of Ideas, The Origins of Our Authoritarian Age, and in this book, Dr. Kendi charts how the great replacement theory has moved from the margins to become the most dominant political theory of our times.
And for those who don't know what
claims,
what is?
Go ahead.
No, you.
No, I'm.
It's your book?
I got to know. Not my book. It's his book. And what we can do to safeguard democracy from this threat, which he believes is insidious. And I will say the history, we go back thousands of years in this book, and it's really riveting and great. And he will be with us for the full hour tomorrow at 11 o'clock.
Wow.
So we're very excited about that. That is cool. Also, I have too many props for the radio. Ani DiFranco is going to be at the New York State Writers Institute, the Creative Life Series. I'll be hosting a conversation with her at Page Hall 7:30 Tuesday evening. You can find out more information by going to the New York State Writers Institute website or go to our WAMC on the Road website. And you can check out It's the Spirit of Ani, Reflections on Spirituality, Feminism, Music, and Freedom. And I'll be in conversation with her. She won't be performing, but she will be. We will be in conversation, and there'll be signed books, and it'll be great. And we'll have a wonderful time at Page Hall as part of the Creative Life series, which I mentioned the other day. Seems like we just started, but I guess we've been doing it for like 13, 14 years now. Mm-hmm. And they roll the pictures of all the ones that we've done. It's like your life flashing before your eyes. It's really cool people that we've done over the years, but and certainly add Ani DiFranco to that list. So
we love the New York State Writers Institute. It's such a gift to the region, and when you host, always a special treat.
Well, thank you. I always have fun hosting. I think I had a choice because there were two. The Monday night guest is Joe Manchin.
Yes. And I'll be there. Yeah. I'll be there.
Well, me too. I mean,
absolutely.
I can't wait for that. I got questions for him. I bet you do.
I don't think he's going to take the questions, but I'll be asking it in my head.
I bet you do. So they've got some great stuff coming up. So check all that out. All right. I will I'll admit we learned late that one of our panelists had to drop out. So we have two wonderful panelists with us today, and we're going to we work with them today. And thank you. You guys got lots of time to talk about
that's
stuff.
Right.
So that's right. Good. Go for it. Let me introduce them to you, and we will get started. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois joins us. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
I'm doing okay. So the world's spinning. But I'm doing all right.
And yes, it does seem to be that way.
Spinning a little faster. Overnight, it seems like the AP headlines kept getting worse and worse throughout the night. It just was.
Dear Teresa walked in, and she had the Pete Hegseth press conference playing live as she walked in. And Bob and I just looked at her like, what are you doing? Like, why get yourself all upset?
I was actually trying to calm myself from the trauma of some wild driver almost sideswiped me. So
Pete Hegseth is going to calm you down? All right, well.
Anyway, but no, it's important to listen to what he says. Just to
agree. No, that's true.
Which was really traumatizing listening. But anyway, here we go.
We also welcome Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College. Bob Brigham is with us, specialist in the history of U.S. foreign policy. We have lots to talk about today in that regard, so good morning.
Good morning, Joe. I'm happy to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much for doing this, and we welcome you, the listener, panel at WAMC.org, if you would like to get in, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to have you join us for this morning's program. All right, let's get to the news of the day and what is happening in the world. And so the U.S. is considering new steps on oil as a tax are rattling the energy markets. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that the Trump administration could release more oil from American reserves as it scrambles to avert a sustained energy crisis set off by the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran. The Trump administration says that it is considering these steps. Prices are soaring. And where did Scott Bessent say this? Oh, right. Fox Business News. And the saying that the government may unsanction the Iranian oil that is already being shipped, about 140 million barrels, that the U.S. could also release more oil into its own strategic reserves. The administration appeared to be scrambling for solutions as news of the latest attacks on Gulf energy infrastructure sent the price of Brent crude, the international benchmark for oil, jumping by nearly 10% to $118 a barrel this morning. European natural gas prices surged as much as 30%. The Dow The markets open at 9:30. Iran was continuing a barrage of attacks on energy infrastructure in the Persian Gulf in retaliation for an Israeli attack on a gas field on Wednesday. Qatar, a major global energy supplier, said that Iranian attacks had damaged gas sites. The world's, including Rosslafen, is that correct? Rosslafen Terminal, the world's largest liquefied natural gas facility. Drone attacks caused fires at two state-owned refineries in Kuwait, and a drone fell at a key energy export terminal in Saudi Arabia. And the United Arab Emirates officials said that the authorities had responded to incidents at gas facilities and an oil field caused by debris from missile interceptions. Still, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth projected confidence at a news briefing at the Pentagon this morning. This is the one Teresa was watching. Telling reporters, quote, "We're winning decisively and in our terms." He declined to offer a timeline when the war might end. That seems to be the way those questions go. "We're doing great. Oh, if we're doing so great, why isn't it over? Well, we still have things to do." Okay. So Mr. Hegseth said that the U.S. military had struck over 7,000 targets in Iran since the war started nearly 3 weeks ago, damaging or sinking over 120 Iranian Navy ships and leaving its military ports, quote, crippled. He dismissed discussion of the war's conduct and the possibility that it could expand into a regional conflict as just, quote, noise. You are shaking your head, rightfully so. Bob, we'll start with you.
Well, you couldn't. You probably could not construct a bigger mess than they have right now, and they've done a very poor job of managing this. The United States has never had a good record in asymmetrical warfare. We tend to use big unit warfare. We tend to put big weapon systems in play. And what we're doing in Iran is exactly that. But at some point, I think Congress is going to demand some kind of accounting, and that's when we're going to see that all of this firepower can knock out targets, but it really can't change political will, or it can't end the battle the way that the Trump administration thinks it can. Asymmetrical warfare can go on forever, and Iran is one of the best countries in the world at asymmetrical warfare. You know, they have tens of thousands of moored contact mines in the Gulf. That every time the Pentagon games this out, it takes 2 months to get rid of 1,000 mines, and there are tens of thousands of mines. So we're looking at a 2-year project without being shot at. It's just inconceivable that this stuff hasn't really been thought through. Magnetic mines are there. The Shahed drones are incredibly effective, incredibly cheap to produce. This is what the Russians are using in Ukraine, but Iran is the lead manufacturer of these. They actually get components from all over the world, and none of that supply chain has been affected. So, you know, underwater drones that can avoid acoustic detection. There's just so much left here that's not said, and that is undone. United States yesterday just began to move a Marine Expeditionary Unit into the Gulf area, led by the U.S. Tripoli. This is an amphibious-ready group. It usually has about 2,000 Marines attached to it. And if I was a member of Congress in the Armed Services Committee or the Foreign Relations Committee, I would have Hegseth in a hearing, and I would ask him, how many divisions is it going to take until you can claim political military victory, if that's really what you're saying you've done? And the answer is going to be probably 20, and that's 200,000.
That's fascinating. I apologize for being cynical, but do you really think he would know that?
No, he wouldn't know that. In fact, I think that they're...
I don't mean...
You know, that's the trouble with this administration.
Right.
You don't know where they are on a map in any given day, but they've just moved... You know, moving a Marine Expeditionary Unit into the area is a precursor to a ground Marine invasion.
Yes.
And that
slippery slope.
It's a slippery slope.
Can I ask... What I'm unclear about is, where will the boots be on the ground? I mean, I know in the Straits that there is one area that we talked about, but where, because this is such a disparate areas of attack.
Yeah, and it's one of the most inhospitable coastlines to try to attack, to try to land.
And what are they going to attack? Are they going to take over the oil fields? I truly don't understand.
I don't either. I mean, I think that's the problem, and they don't understand, and that's the bigger problem.
Yeah.
But if you had an interest in, which this administration doesn't, if you had an interest in history and the history of this kind of aerial attack, you'd read
bombing surveys, right?
You'd understand that in World War II, bombing was going to take you so far, but eventually you had to land Patton. You had to get down with heavy mechanized units to roll across Europe. You don't need heavily mechanized units in this theater of operation, but you are, to achieve the objectives that they keep saying they want to achieve, you're going to have boots on the ground.
Well, Senator Mark Kelly, who was a Navy pilot bomber, has said that over and over again in the last week, that you can't do what they claim they're trying to do without boots on the ground. You can't do this from the sky, is what he keeps saying.
Yeah, and let me take that one step further and say that
they've been saying since the beginning.
They have been saying from the beginning, and the bombing surveys from World War II show the same thing. All the national intelligence estimates and the Jason studies from Vietnam show the same thing. You cannot achieve your geostrategic objectives with high-level bombing. It doesn't work. And so, this is a slippery slope. My guess is that they won't go too far down that lane because they're going to have such a mess of other problems that the first caskets coming home in high numbers might chill this. But with this administration, they're totally unpredictable.
So I have so many follow-up questions, as I know Teresa does as well. We're gonna take a break for a second, and we'll get some news from the BBC, some updates on what is happening in the world, including what's happening in Iran and the latest bombings. We'll hear about that as well. But I also I want to get to the price of oil, and then I also want to get to this idea of, if you keep saying that we're winning, I don't know what the definition of that is when we seem to be in the quote unquote mess that you have just laid out, that seems to be the mess that most experts are laying out, that I think is obviously what so many of us are greatly concerned about. And if it is going so great, then why is all that other stuff happening? So we'll get into that as well. We are joined by Teresa Bourgeois and Robert Brigham with us this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We would love to have you with us. We have new notes on your letters, and we ask you to keep them short and to the point and on topic. One per show, one per customer, folks. Do all that, and we'll see you soon right after this.
For free.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Listening to the music of Andrea von Kampen playing Cafe Lena on the 21st of this month at 8 p.m. You can find out more by going to cafelena.org, cafe with two Fs, cafelena.org. And the playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. Bob Brigham, Teresa Bourgeois with us this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. At the beginning of the show, as I was reading from the New York Times, their coverage of this, and specifically as to oil and the use of the reserves, and it seems the word that came up several times during that was scrambling. And this administration has been scrambling over the last week and a half, 2 weeks, over oil prices. And various reserves and various ideas have come into fruition, and various tariffs and so forth have been removed to try to improve that. Are we seeing any impact on those efforts? Because it seems like the price just keeps to be going up, 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 up when all of these things are being done, being sort of thrown at the wall to see what sticks. Is anything sticking?
Well, I'm listening to a few different experts. I had heard over and over again that even if they make these adjustments, it'll take 6 months or more. Even if this thing stopped now, it would take 6 months or more to recalibrate, to deal with what is happening in the oil markets. And I think it's interesting to know that the Japanese Prime Minister is at the White House today. She's visiting in the U.S., and I heard some TV coverage of they have record fuel prices there, gas prices there. And so this war is not their war, but it's impacting their wallets. And all over the world, you hear different stories of rationing or some governments closing their offices early or asking people to conserve. I don't hear the president asking people in the U.S. to conserve. But this is a global oil shock. And given the bombings that you talked about over the during the night, I think that's only going to, you know, the destruction of this core infrastructure, it's only going to escalate and get worse. And that raises the broader question of the U.S. dependence on oil as opposed to clean energy and other forms of energy. We were moving away from that for a long time, and President Trump, you know, really stopped all those efforts and put big bets on oil, and probably closely related to the, remember the famous meeting when he was running for office and he met with the key oil companies and, you know, they gave him $1 billion and he focused on that business. But I think that for our own national safety and our own economic security, we really need to move away from this. Data point that I heard the other day is that, you know, this issue of whether or not these oil tankers should be moving through the straits, right? The Strait of Hormuz. And one of the issues is, can they be insured to do so? And so Trump administration said, well, we'll provide reinsurance. We'll provide insurance. But the price tag for that, for the American taxpayers, is $20 billion. So $20 billion of our money to provide insurance for these oil companies that are making enormous amounts of money to protect them from the decisions that the Trump administration made to go in and without realizing that the Straits of Hormuz would be closed. But as was pointed out in a hearing yesterday, if you just read last year's national security report, it's right in there.
I mean, no matter, we try to keep the topics sort of unfolding as we go, but they're so linked that it's difficult to do that. But at some point, we can talk about it in depth. Meanwhile, they're going to ask for another $200 billion.
That $200 billion is on top of $1.5 trillion, which is a huge increase year on year. And most of that $200 billion is for replacement weapons that they've used in this bombing and used in Ukraine. You know, that we're down our interceptors, which intercept, you know, incoming missiles.
At a
down,
price tag of roughly.
Yeah. Down 25%, new Tomahawks, new Patriots. So this is just replacing hardware with hardware. That doesn't change the problem. No. You're not going to bomb yourself out of this problem. It just isn't, you know, the Trump administration thought that they could do this. They thought they could do this on the cheap. And now they're slowly, well, maybe they're not understanding, but we're slowly understanding that this has enormous ripples. It's not just the oil prices, it's gas prices. It's fertilizer. A third of the world's fertilizer goes through the Gulf. And in 2 weeks, if plants aren't fertilized in the Northern Hemisphere, there's going to be malnutrition. There'll be pocket starvation.
Well, I mean, think about the agriculture community in this country and around the world, but just think about American farmers and what the assaults on American farmers, with the immigrant crackdown, They don't have workers because they can't get the people coming in legally as they had in the past. With the tariffs, that has with the cut in USAID programs, it cuts out a lot of their markets in both cases. And now they can't even get fertilizer to for their farms. I mean, this is just a tremendous economic blow here and around the world.
In the Trump administration's efforts to keep gas prices from going, you know, from doubling in the next 2 months, this idea that you're going to allow Russia to release sanctioned oil for a short period of time, that's gone. Russia is back on the oil market, and which means they can sustain the war in Ukraine forever. They can disrupt other parts of the region that are going to be vital to U.S. security interests. China gets 17.7% of its oil from Russia. It gets 14.9% of its oil from Saudi Arabia. It only gets 10% from Iran.
But think about the fact that the Trump and Vance administration lifted the sanctions on Russia is just stunning.
It's mind-boggling.
Lifted the sanctions on Russia and filled their coffers with money.
And just to double down and make sure you get all of this right, in the hollowing out of U.S. capacity in international affairs included the only person in the State Department that tracks sanctioned supertankers. He no longer works for the government.
So a long time ago, like 7 or 8 days ago, Josh Hawley was on Fox News and basically was answering these questions, and as I'm going to use a Teresa term, which is said the quiet part out loud, which is what we need to do is just claim victory and move on. And that seemed to be in the cards for a while for the Trump administration. It also seems now, 7 or 8 days later, we've moved beyond that. I don't know how we do that now. And even if there is an admission, this continual refrain from the president of saying, you know, we're winning, but we need to win more, to fill in the blank to say, yeah, we're not ready to do that yet. That does not seem to be at all feasible.
I think you're right, Joe. And I think that we've lost control not only of the narrative, but of the action. If we leave, if we take this Marine Expeditionary Corps and we leave the Gulf, that doesn't mean Iran stops. You know, they've poked the bear. Iran is very good at reaching out to its neighbors and spoiling their lives. They've been doing it for a long time. We no longer can dictate the terms of this conflict, and that's a position you never want to find yourself in a war.
Right, and Netanyahu, of course, is also, you know, they are doing targeted killings of Iranian leaders, and the question is some of them, you know, again, I'm not an expert, but what I was reading experts saying is some of the people, is it wise to have done that? Because there's some people that they could negotiate with who have negotiating power who are now dead. And so the question is, who in the end will be in charge there? Because you're not going to get regime change, but you do have to figure out who the leader is going to be. And it was interesting, too. I was hearing a discussion about, because Trump is very upset about the NATO allies not wanting to come in. As they said, it's not our war. And so he's been, you know, quite vocal about that. But as someone was saying, that one of their fears is they come in and then he leaves and leaves them with the mess to clean up. And it's, you know, they didn't make the mess. And it's hard to figure out how this is going to get settled out, because you can maybe, you know, we can say we're going to stop bombing. But as you say, it doesn't mean Israel stops, and it doesn't mean that they don't stop in retribution for what's happened.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I have a lot of letters in front of me. I would like to get to those and follow up on a couple of the things that we have been talking about this morning. And we will do exactly that. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this.
Why can't you see the trees for the woods just one?
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And it's very nice to have you with us on this Thursday morning. It's the 19th of March. It's 46 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. Teresa Bourgeois is here. Bob Brigham is here. And we welcome you into the discussion. We have a lot of letters, and I'll get to those in just a moment as we talk about. We began our discussion this morning in talking about what happened overnight and in what the U.S. is considering in regards to dealing with the attacks that are rattling the energy markets and the steps that the U.S. is taking on oil. But obviously, we're talking about the war at large as well. I'm curious as to the when we think of where we are right now, and let me ask it another way. Is to me this seems dire, and I don't is there a part of this that we should look at to take some solace in?
We have a Congress that has oversight responsibilities.
Okay, besides that's it.
Well, that there are signs that it's not part of the public discourse, but I know that flag officers are resigning in protest over what they see as a reckless policy.
A flag officer being
a rear admiral and an admiral in the Navy.
Okay,
and so they clearly understand what's being asked of them, and that
this is different than Joe Kent leaving.
This is different than Joe Kent leaving.
Know who Joe Kent is,
he's the National Counterterrorism Director in the DNI. In the National
Tulsi Gabbard's number two.
Right. He left. He's a Trumper, and he resigned because he thought this war was foolish. Foolish and reckless. I teach my students in history and international relations in the first year. It's one rule. Don't go looking for trouble in international relations because it'll find you whether you want it or not. And this is a war of choice. And in war of choices, you do get to a crossover point. And I think that what you're feeling as a dire situation is because I think your suggestion that 7 or 8 days ago doing a Senator Aiken in Vietnam and just declaring victory and go home was possible. But we've lost control of this. And you never want to lose the control like we have in a conflict. And so I think the situation is dire.
And not to, I mean, I tried to temper this, but it's to have this go on, and then in real time you're watching the president see another shiny object in Cuba, and it's just your mind just. At least mine is like...
It's whack-a-mole with bad decisions.
Right. I just like, how is that going to help us at all?
Yeah.
And I don't... And just because it's there for the taking, maybe? And also that would indicate to me that we've really learned nothing in the last month of what these actions have taken.
Exactly. And these are headline-grabbing things that Trump needs for a variety of reasons, most of them an impoverished personality, probably. But... the central command is very concerned about these ever-growing responsibilities. There was some pushback even on moving this Marine Expeditionary Unit into the region because you have fixed resources. And, the fear is that an aggressive foreign policy like this leads to another shoe dropping, and you don't have the force structure to put out fires all around the globe at once.
And the suffering that it's causing all around the world. I mean, think about the suffering in Cuba right now because the U.S. has blocked their access to energy, so they're operating in the dark with no fuel. And that's apparently how we're going to go in and take them over. I mean, we can't even, you know, Puerto Rico hasn't even recovered from hurricanes because their energy sectors are out, right?
Yeah.
And I know a group of people are going down there and helping putting up solar panels and such because the U.S. government is not helping, right? And so we're going to take on Cuba, but we're not going to take them on until we have, till the Trump Vance administration, it's not we, it's the Trump Vance administration, has blocked their access to fuel. And they are suffering right now because of that. That's not going to engender them to us. And where is Venezuela headed? And there's no regime change
right.
there.
I was going to say that. The jury's still out on that one.
But also, if you look all around the think about the hundreds of thousands of people in Lebanon and Syria and Kuwait and all over the region who have now been displaced from their homes. And you think about all the horrible anguish and rubble in Gaza. But now some of the pictures coming out of Lebanon and other places that have been bombed, it's the same thing, the same pictures of just massive destruction and kids standing there in the midst of the rubble looking dazed and confused and wounded, right? Yeah. It's just these mass movements of people with no place to go. The human cost of this all around the globe is overwhelming.
I think experienced officers in the Pentagon are probably also very nervous that the continual attacks, air attacks inside Iran are going to have an unanticipated effect, which would be to turn the population against. The population was very much in favor of U.S. support for their anti-regime measures. But at some point, bombing can have that kind of impact. Our surveys from World War II show that, even though there was growing antagonism towards the Nazi regime, bombing kind of solid that political will. And so there's a danger that you can bomb the population to be against you.
How did they get that message through?
How did the officers get?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the problem. When you don't have, this whole from Gabbard and Hegseth and Rubio down, you usually have a process. So let me back up, Joe. Intelligence failures. When Gabbard says Trump is the person that decided that this was an imminent threat.
This was yesterday. During the hearing and said that all intelligence decisions. I'll just let that sit for a second. End with the president.
And that's the worst thing she could have said. It saved her job and it destroyed the systems that are in place to make prudent and wise decisions in the United States. You know, the United States has the largest national security bureaucracy in the world. The Defense Intelligence Agency is second to none. The national intelligence estimates are spot on. Usually our intelligence failures are about missing something somewhat obvious. This is the first time in memory that I can think of where we have an intelligence failure that's because the director of national intelligence didn't do their job.
But also, the AP had a story that ran early this morning. State Department cuts jobs with deep expertise in Middle East as Iran crisis escalates. And they just do an assessment of, and they say, and I'm quoting here, in divisions of the State Department that typically would handle the Iran response, numerous veteran diplomats with decades of collective experience were fired, retired, or reassigned, replaced by more junior officials or political appointees. The administration cut more than 80 staffers in the Near Eastern Affairs divisions. And then they go on to say that they cut, they drove out some of the leading, the key ambassadorships were left vacant, some of the leading experts, and also those with language capacity. Many, many of them were ousted. 3,800 employees overall, but particularly hard hit was this bureau, this region, with the expertise that is so desperately needed right now. So you don't have that knowledge base. You don't have those people with the relationships that can have the kinds of discussions that you need to be having right now because the Trump administration fired or drove them out.
Yeah, I think that's why Joe's use of the word dire is appropriate, because this is really a catastrophe in several different levels and in several different spheres. It's really does have this potential to have long legs. And
we've alienated our allies. I mean, what's the impact of that, to have not shored up our allies?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge question. The other question I keep asking guests, and I think I may have even asked this to you earlier in the war, is, so this is going back to the idea of, you know, if we leave the equation, which, you know, I don't think we can do at this point, but where does that leave the Israeli army then, and our relationship with them? And where is the so much of this is now with the killing of the two leaders this week, that coming from the Israeli army, where does that leave the partnership, for want of a better term, between these two armies and government, of how that is moving forward? Because it seems like they're different pages.
I would agree. And I know that there was some criticism of U.S. relationship with Israel, with Israel's military on this endeavor. And there were even some critics who said that, you know, Trump didn't make the decision to go to war, that Netanyahu made the decision to go to war with Iran. But put those criticisms aside, I think you're right. I think this is going to strain that relationship as well, because Israel's gone all in on this and has opened up this new theater in southern Lebanon. But it can only, I would think, it could only continue to meet its geopolitical objectives with the United States as a partner in this.
But reportedly, Vance administration was goaded into this by Israel, but also by Saudi Arabia. And, I mean, I saw that there was bombing in Riyadh yesterday and overnight, too.
Yeah, I can't imagine the Saudis are very happy about what's going on.
Right, here. But this has, I'm sure, gone much further than they would have anticipated.
Yeah. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters. We'll get to those. And we welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue a couple other aspects of the story that I'd like to get to, and then we'll move on to other topics completely. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return after this short break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. Teresa Bourgeois is here, public policy and communications expert. Robert Brigham joins us, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College, specialist in the history of U.S. foreign policy. We have a lot of letters. I would like to get to those, and we'll make our way through them. If you would like to add to the pile, all you have to do is write to us. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Just one per show. Keep them short, to the point, on topic, and pre-read them so they make sense. Greg writes, why does an anti-Netanyahu statement necessarily denote anti-Semitism? I strongly oppose the Netanyahu government, but do not consider myself anti-Semitic. I don't see Joe Kent as anti-Semitic. That was an issue that came up in the resignation letter from Joe Kent, who we described earlier in the program. Anybody want to address that?
I don't understand it myself, because I keep hearing this. If you raise questions or concerns about the decisions that the Netanyahu government has taken, in this and in Gaza, then you're anti-Semitic. And I really don't understand that, because I do think some of the decisions that they have made in Gaza and are making now are issues that need to be scrutinized.
Yeah, I would only add to that that the charters of the UN and most international arrangements allow for criticisms of governments, and there's a process for adjudicating when those criticisms turn into legal affairs, whether you're going to take them to the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court. So states are susceptible to criticism for their actions in the world.
And just as an aside, I think that it's tragic that not enough attention is being given to Gaza right now, because the data points there are just tragic in terms of the still not letting enough humanitarian aid in.
Right.
Too many people, particularly children, that are just living in intense and terrible conditions without enough food. It's really an unfathomable situation there, so that has not gotten the attention that it needs, and the Trump Vance administration is not helping on the humanitarian side in the way that we should be, and it's just tragic.
Mike writes to us and says, much of the coverage of the war speculates about when Trump will declare victory and call it a day. What they focus less on is that Iran gets a vote, too. Why would Iran end the war without security guarantees and reparations? They have proved that they can hold the world economy hostage, and that's a powerful tool. Even if Trump declared a victory tomorrow, Iran can continue doing what it's doing. They don't even need to launch that many drones or missiles, just enough to scare shipping companies from moving through the Strait of Hormuz. I don't think this war is ending anytime soon.
I would agree.
That's what you
were saying
earlier.
I would agree totally. And then, you know, in the history of modern warfare, there's never been a country I can think of that's as good as this at this kind of asymmetrical warfare. You know, small boats, small underwater drones. You know, they can dictate the time and place where they decide to create havoc, and that can go on indefinitely. So, yes, I agree with the letter writer completely.
And you heard Defense Secretary Hegseth this morning, who was disparaging former President Bush, Biden, and Obama for not being willing to go into this region. But they understood well the broad, you know, global implications of doing so, and you know, they were, I think those administrations were smart enough to know what the implications would be and didn't take these moves, and President Obama took the diplomacy move, which was, you know, it's slogging and it's difficult and it takes a long time, but you don't end up with a global crisis. And you don't end up with people in Iran turning against you, which, as we talked about a little while ago, is where this seems to be headed, and justifiably so.
This is a request from Martha. Could you please explain what asymmetrical warfare is?
Yeah, asymmetrical warfare is when you have one side that has a clear superiority in conventional military means and another side that doesn't have anywhere near that kind of capacity but can and will engage in warfare at a much lower level. So the United States holds preponderant military power in the world, but Iran is a really good user of drones and mines and IEDs, as we learned in the Iraq War. A lot of the IEDs were actually manufactured in Iran. And so they can fight what we would have called it during the Vietnam War. They can fight a guerrilla war while the United States is fighting a big unit war. The United States can achieve all of its objectives it needs to with big unit war, less so when it moves to something like counterinsurgency or other things like that. So asymmetrical war, in an asymmetrical war, the lesser power often trades land for time. Time is their most valuable asset. And so Iran wants to stretch this thing out as long as possible to morally, economically, politically, and militarily exhaust the United States. Democracies in general do not do well in asymmetrical wars because there's always an election. You always are facing your constituents and trying to explain something that in this case you started and is going to take decades to actually clean up. And, you know, there's no patience for that kind of a conflict in an industrialized Western democracy.
And am I right, this is a question, not a statement, that in Ukraine it was just the opposite in the sense that the Russians had the weapons, the high-powered weapons and such. In Ukraine it was thought that Russia would come in and take them over right away. But the Ukrainian military, they have a very strong capacity with targeted drone strikes.
Yes.
And they just sat back and are very strategic about how they use them.
Yeah, and another major difference with the Russians is their military leadership is really haphazard. They don't have good chain of command. The United States has excellent chain of command. Mm-hmm. So that they are going to be more susceptible to kind of asymmetrical attacks along the border of the Donbass than the United States would be in Iran. But as Joe said earlier, this is dire because we've lost control of where and when things happen. And once that happens in a conflict, then you've entered a totally new war arena, and it's dangerous. So it's a great question by the letter.
Can I ask a follow-up? Also, I guess, again, question, not statement. Isn't it right that it seemed that the U.S. didn't think that Iran would strike their neighbors who host U.S. bases, but in fact Iran has done that, but not overwhelmingly, but enough to wake them up, to start moving. It's caused people to flee.
Yeah, and I think that's again to affect the price of oil. Obviously, I don't think it's the smartest military and political move that Iran could do, but it's
affecting the global markets.
It's affecting global markets. I do think it's an act of desperation, and it might lead to more harm than good for Iran. Maybe rightfully so. But it's definitely aimed
at using the tools they have.
They're using it, and that's what in an asymmetrical warfare, what's really at play are the weapons of the weak, and that's what you're going to see.
But their biggest weapon is the Strait of Hormuz, that they can shut it down.
Biggest weapon is the price of oil right now. Right. Yeah.
All right. Let's go back to the letters. Panel at WAMC.org, if you would like in on that. We got this letter from Barbara, who says, good morning. Say goodbye to our country.
No.
Say goodbye to everything we know and love. Trump has no clue what he is doing, nor do any of his toadies. Together, they will bring... So it's like, apparently, I'm not the only one feeling a little dire. Together they will bring devastating war to our land, if not the entire world. Perhaps this is his warped thinking. If I can't be president anymore, then I'll wipe out the world. It is his me, and only me logic. Also, taking over country after country. What else could we expect from someone whose only background is in real estate other than to collect as much land as he possibly can to develop for his own profit? I would also, I think that's a...
But I think the voters have a say in that, and I think they've been having their say in these primaries, and November's coming, and can't come soon enough.
We have a couple letters like that, so I probably will read another one here that sounds similar but different. We had a letter from Diane who says, I would direct all of the WAMC listeners to watch the discussion with General McChrystal, who served under both Presidents Bush and Obama. That is part of the NOLA book discussion presented by the Atlantic magazine. I just looked it up. You can find that on YouTube. It is available. It took place a couple days ago. He answers direct questions without skirting anything, and he speaks with honor and knowledge. Also, we go to Jay. I'd like to make a horrible prediction that Trump and his appointees are the kind of people that have egos too big to admit failure. Due to this, he will never quit, and we will suffer because of this. We must demand him out. Tell your representatives to stand up to Trump and his power.
I think that is key. I think that if Senate Republicans and House Republicans, I know we've been saying this for a long time, but at some point, when is enough enough? And that he has to hear from them, and he also has to hear from the business community and his big donors, the tech and oil folks. and when he starts hearing from them. And obviously he's affected by the dropping markets, but I want to hear from, and also, you know, he doesn't seem to be responding yet to the agriculture community, but big ag, this is hurting family farms of big ag also. But I'd like to hear from some military families and hear how they're doing, because I so worry about them right now.
Lisa writes to us and says, just wondering if marine animals can activate underwater mines. The staggering loss of human life is unbelievably horrid, but few consider the devastating impact of war on those other beings we share the planet with. We check in with another Teresa, who says, the only way to end this insanity is to take the keys away from the lunatic who's driving the car. Then we go to Craig. By dropping sanctions on Russia, Trump is paying Putin to supply Iran with military intelligence so Iran can kill American soldiers.
And where?
He's not wrong. I mean, the clear connection between Russian intelligence and the use of the Shahed drones is there. It's despicable that the Trump administration would allow this kind of thing to go unchecked. And as I said earlier, I think this very temporary opening of Russian oil to markets is not going to be temporary. It'll be permanent. And that too, will be globe-changing.
And I think we're going to get to this, but almost no questions about that yesterday with Gabbard and others. Why is there not outrage about this? I'm repeating myself, but why is there not outrage, even among Republicans?
There are some Republicans that are, you know, standing up, and this is going to take time, though. These kind of things, Congress moves very slowly. And even something as outrageous as what the administration is doing without consulting. I mean, this the Gabbard thing has legs because sooner or later, the president is going to have to answer to War Powers Act concerns. And usually the president notifies the appropriate members of Congress through the DNI. Here was our intelligence. I mean, the Bush administration had faulty intelligence, but that didn't mean that there wasn't intelligence. You know, there were no weapons of mass destruction, but the intelligence said there was because Saddam said there was for self-preservation. And then Bush had the, you know, Colin Powell went to the UN and sold it. There hasn't been that moment yet, but there will be that moment. There has to be that moment.
But out ahead of that moment, you could have the, you know, they have his cell phone number. You know, you could have the Republicans calling, or when they're all down at Mar-a-Lago at their fundraisers, they could be talking to him about it. And you don't hear that there have been these back channels, you know, opposition to lifting those sanctions.
This is, from what we were talking about in the hearing that took place yesterday, it's actually two we want to talk about. One is Tulsi Gabbard. The other one is the confirmation hearing for Mark Wayne Mullen. But President Trump has taken on many ancillary roles in Washington. This from the Washington Post and David Sanger and Julian Barnes. Chairman of the Kennedy Center, the de facto chief architect of the city's landmark properties, and now the nation's chief intelligence analyst. This revelation came from Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence. She had the unenviable task of, at a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on Wednesday, squaring Mr. Trump's comments about an urgent nuclear threat from Iran with a letter from one of her trusted aides that the country posed no imminent threat. Her answer? Only the president can decide what is imminent. In other words, she was turning one of the key roles of the intelligence community's 80,000 employees to make non-political judgments about threats to American security over to Mr. Trump. Ms. Gabbard's comments were necessitated by the decision of Joe Kent, her close advisor, to quit his counterterrorism position over his opposition to the war in Iran and his belief that Israel had pressured the United States into the conflict. Democrats, long critical of Mr. Kent and his penchant for conspiracy theories, jumped on his comments about the war, creating at least a short-term communications crisis for the Trump administration. I cannot in good conscience support the ongoing war in Iran, Mr. Kent wrote In a letter to Mr. Trump, Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation. Ms. Gabbard does not quickly turn on her allies, and she showed little desire to throw Mr. Kent under the bus or attack him yesterday, but she has remained in her position by being a careful student of Mr. Trump and knows how to stay on his good side.
And Trump said he barely knows Kent, and he's a weak person.
Well, he was a good guy. I liked him. He was, I believe it was in this order. He's a good guy. I liked him. He was very weak on security, which is why I made him head of security.
Right.
And then, but I don't really know him at all.
I don't really know him. It's a typical Trump handling of this. I mean, I think this is a crisis that may have legs, and we may see Congress actually take this up, because it's more than 80,000 actually that make up the intelligence community, because each of the service branches has their own intelligence communities as well. There's lots of civilians that are involved in doing off-book intelligence reports for the DIA, for example, the Defense Intelligence Agency. This is the largest national security bureaucracy in the world. And to throw all of that considered expertise away because the president says that Iran was 2 weeks away from having a nuclear weapon is really tragic. It is a weak moment in our democracy.
And I hope this is a good question. But how much of that is just like getting yourself out of a jam, you know, just talking your way out of a paper bag, as opposed to it really meaning anything?
You mean for the administration?
I mean for Gabbard to say that. I mean, it became fairly obvious of like, is it a tell? Or is it the reality that most of it, you know, that many suspect, or is it just a way of getting out of an awkward moment?
Oh, I think this is the reality. I think that, you know, otherwise we would have had members of the administration sitting before the Senate Armed Services Committee saying, here's our evidence. This is why we have to go to war with Iran, which they haven't done yet. I mean, it might be good to take a step back and to remember where the War Powers Act came from. It came from the Vietnam War, and it came after Congress gave Lyndon Johnson a blank check through the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. It got railroaded through the Congress by Senator William Fulbright. Democrats owned both houses. They got it through. It was an election year for Johnson, the first time he was going to stand on election on his own. It was only later that Fulbright and other critics of the war saw that, this was deception involved. The first part of getting to a War Powers Act was repealing the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. And so now we're left with this War Powers Act that demands that the president has to come to Congress and inform the appropriate chairs of Foreign Relations and Armed Services. And that hasn't happened in a way that it normally happens in history. The Republicans who chair those committees say, oh, the president has informed us. But usually it's very specific hearings. Usually there's evidence brought forward. And maybe this is the beginning, this thing that Gabbard is saying, that the president and the president alone decided that Iran had the capability of a nuclear weapon in 2 weeks. That's the kind of thing that should lead to a War Powers Resolution investigation.
But and I'm sorry, Teresa, but it was also just goes with the of him saying, well, I just went with my gut.
Right. Just go with your gut.
Yeah.
Ignore, you know, the most incredible expertise ever gathered in a city for anything. Ignore that and go with your gut, which has been right so many times before.
But she was very artful in not taking responsibility, right? And that I thought that she emphasized over and over again that these were not her views, they were the collective views, and that the information was available. And she didn't throw Trump and Vance under the bus in any way, shape, or form. She was, you know, artful around that. But I think if you read between the lines, it was clear that she knew that they knew that he had this information, and it was his decision of how to use it or not. But what was interesting to me was the exchange with Senator John Ossoff from Georgia, where he said he pressed her and, you know, specifically, yes or no, was there a, quote, imminent nuclear threat posed by the Iranian regime, yes or no? And that's where she said it's not the responsibility of the intelligence community to determine what is or is not an imminent threat. But he came back at her and said, it is precisely your responsibility to determine what constitutes a threat to the United States. And then in this article, they say, in fact, he's right, that the it is their responsibility. And the CIA director, Ratcliffe, when he was asked, he danced around it a little more artfully, I think, and giving a non-answer answer. That was, I think, the Ossoff exchange was very clarifying, and that she was supposed to have an answer, and she didn't give one.
A couple more letters, and then we'll go to a break at the bottom of the hour. We go to a couple on this topic. I believe the charge of anti-Semitism against Kent's statements had to do with the implication that this war is being ruled by global elites. A dog whistle for me, a non-observant Jew who does not at all support Israel's long conservative oppression of Palestinians. That from Liz. Then Aaron writes, many Jewish people, including people in Israel who are Jewish, do not support the Netanyahu government. It is not anti-Semitic to believe this. It is no different than not supporting the Trump administration. We are not un-American for opposing his policies. We are also not anti-Semitic for opposing the policies of Benjamin Netanyahu. That notion is completely absurd. Couple more. We go to Deb, who says, this is a pick-me-up, too. Deb says, the end-timers are in charge, and they're gleefully cheering on climate change and war and rising disease, the anti-vaxxers, and now the potential for famine and economic collapse if the war continues. Lori checks in and says, I have only one piece of advice for Congress. Impeach this fool now, before he bankrupts this country.
Can I say
yes?
Quick bit about climate change. One of the things that was interesting, and it was pointed out during the hearing by at least two or maybe three senators and David Sanger in this really good New York Times article, that these previous reports from year to year, administration to administration, typically contain the same focus and sometimes in a little bit different order. And it notes that the Biden administration, Russia aggression, and Chinese ability to compete against the United States militarily and technologically were at the top of the list, and that the Trump-Vance administration, in those cases, they weren't. They put immigration and border security, homeland defense at the top of the list. But what they left out completely was climate change and public health threats, those two things. And to leave out climate change, so important to the military and to all of us, is really a miss.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll wrap up the we have a half hour, and we have other topics to get to. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome your letters. Last call for those as we head into the home stretch. We'll be back right after this.
Such love, such love, such love now does. The sky, the sky.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I just want to say we were talking during the break, the three of us, about Well, we were trying to find something happy to talk about. And we came up with the one thing that just momentarily that is happy. And I guess it depends on whether you're a Duke fan or not. But Siena College, our very own Siena College.
Siena Saints.
The Siena Saints. And not
they
many,
have a prayer. Are they not anymore?
No, they are. They are. What were they before? They were Siena...
I just know as the Siena Saints. I don't know. And they have a prayer.
And we are so excited for them. Siena is going to the big dance, as they say. And it's the NCAA tournament. They are going to be – that's the good news. The bad news is they're playing the number one seed in the entire tournament. They're playing Duke. And they are a powerhouse, and they have been a powerhouse for a really long time. And there are many, 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 many people who have them winning the whole thing. So we'll see.
So they could be a bracket buster.
But wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it be great? But who cares just to have the Siena Saints in... and that dog. Oh, that's St. Bernard. Oh, mm-hmm. God, that's a great-looking dog. The basketball team in the tournament today. The game is at 2:50. The coverage starts at 2:30. It will be televised in the Capital Region on CBS 6. It'll be on CBS elsewhere. And if you get a chance and want to root for our home team there, that's a big thing and a very cool thing. My dad graduated from Siena in 1950, and classmate of William Kennedy.
Oh, wow.
There you go. Yes, William Kennedy, also a Siena grad. So,
Author
of Ironweed.
Creator of the New York State Writers Institute.
And also, I will just a quick plug. Well, they're putting together a beautiful of the trilogy of those books in the Library of America, and that comes out next month, I believe.
Oh, fantastic!
And Paul Grondahl, our friend Paul Grondahl, is one of the editors, along with Colin McCann, a wonderful Irish writer, and another editor of that book. So that's very cool. But yes, a Siena alum for Bill Kennedy. And we'll root for the.
We're so excited, and I think it's kind of great that they're the number one. I mean, they're going to be in the shining light, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't get any better. Take on the top team.
It's the gold rush.
It's
march
very,
on.
It's very exciting.
That's what we and you know, there's that moment. You know, it could be in just the first
Anything
few minutes,
could happen.
But you know, you just like, it could happen. Yeah, absolutely.
They're going to the dance.
It's very exciting. And and there's a lot of watch parties around, and there's a lot of cool things happening. And so
have fun. Celebrate.
Yeah. Enjoy. We certainly deserve it.
Good luck to all of them.
Wonderful opportunity for the kids at Siena, as well as for the all of the students of that fine university.
It just shines a really nice light on the school, too.
Absolutely. All right. Let's move on to other stuff. And we will talk about, try to get away from war for a moment anyway, and talk about the other things, which, you know, not much better, but we'll... but Udo will do that. And, of course, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Okay, so the other there was the Mullen hearing that took place, and I just received, and I don't know if I still have it up because I think my phone has. But the Senate has moved forward, and they're going to put it. They moved it forward after yesterday's hearing. I think that was a something that just passed on Mark Wayne Mullen to take over for Kristi Noem. And there was the hearing yesterday, and for this fight, and he sparred with Rand Paul. At the confirmation hearing, the fellow senators clashed over Mullen's past criticism of Paul, including calling him a snake, even as Mullen pledged to restore public trust in the agency. He defended his record at a fiery confirmation hearing Wednesday after his nomination to lead the Department of Homeland Security, pledging to restore confidence in the embattled agency after a turbulent year that has led to widespread criticism. Mullen, a Republican of Oklahoma, who is President Donald Trump's pick to replace Kristi Noem, portrayed himself during the three-hour hearing as a seasoned and blunt-spoken lawmaker and a family man, prepared to combat terrorism, enforce immigration laws, and work across party lines for public safety. In a nod to Democrats who excoriated Noem's leadership, Mullen vowed to take DHS in a different direction and to reduce tensions with local officials over immigration enforcement operations as the Trump administration pursues the president's mass deportation agenda. Mullen offered a measure of regret for statements he made accusing Alex Pretty, an American citizen protesting immigration raids, of being a deranged individual after federal immigration officers fatally shot him in Minneapolis in January. Mullen pledged to require officers to obtain judicial warrants before entering private residences, in most cases one of the demands by Democrats who have withheld votes for a new DHS funding bill, which we will also probably talk about in some way before we end this morning as well. Teresa, all you.
I'm so confused about this because I listened to the hearing and the Democrats used their time to talk to him primarily about ICE. The Republicans used their time primarily to talk about the fact that the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, is not funded. So let's deal with that just very quickly, in that the Democrats have repeatedly, both on the House and the Senate side, tried to bring bills through committee and to the floor to fund all parts of the Department of Homeland Security other than ICE and border security until the issues around. So the Democrats believe you should fund the Coast Guard and FEMA and the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, the Secret Service, the Cybersecurity Division, all of it. And the Republicans have over and over and over again refused to bring those bills to a vote. Yet they spent most of the time at the hearing denigrating the Democrats for keeping, you know, causing the TSA lines and such. And so I think that we just need to level set that they used their time in a way that was beyond disingenuous. The other thing is there was no real discussion about Senator Mullen's qualifications. And remember that this is a massive department, the largest one. It's huge. It's complex. 260,000 employees, 80,000 law enforcement employees. And Senator Mullen's background, he's from Oklahoma. He was raised on a farm. His father owned a plumbing business. He worked on the farm, then went to college. While he was in college, his father became ill. He left college to go and help with the farm and the plumbing business, which he eventually took over. All very honorable. It was a big plumbing business, and then he went into construction as well. And then he went into Congress. He has no law enforcement background. He has no transportation background. He has no national security background. He has no background running large and complex organizations. So he just does not come to this very complex job with any of that experience. And then you layer onto that, there are questions which I didn't hear raised in the hearing about some of the stock trades he has done in the past and very recently in advance of the invasion of Venezuela, where he bought some defense contract company stocks just in advance, or they were purchased in his name, he says. But there was no real assessment of that. So it just, and again, Department of Homeland Security is made up of Coast Guard, FEMA, TSA, Secret Service, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which has been gutted by the Trump-Vance administration, the ICE, the United States Immigration Customs Enforcement, United States Customs and Border Control, and a whole host of other. There's health security component, homeland situational security component. There's a science and technology component. These are essential to our homeland security. And the person who the Trump administration wants to have in charge of that just comes to it with just woefully lack of experience. And then as Senator Rand Paul showed through clips of Mark Wayne Mullen, he seems to have a anger management issues. Oh, I forgot to mention that he does have experience in, Joe, was it? I get it wrong.
MMA,
not so mixed martial arts. So I think it's deeply disturbing.
Not ecstasy. Go ahead.
Right.
So anyway, I just find that the lack of scrutiny and discussion, and that's before we even get into the details of which I'd like to talk about the detention centers and things like that. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
I mean, to me, what was interesting about the hearing yesterday, besides the brief confrontation between Rand Paul and Mullen over Mullen's threatening to fight people on the floor of the Senate, which he has done repeatedly, and his statements that he...
And who intervened? Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders intervened, exactly. And he, you know, he was very... kind of congratulatory to the folks that have caused Rand Paul physical harm in the past. So there was a brief tense exchange there. But to me, what was remarkable about this hearing, and I agree with Teresa completely, he's totally unqualified for this position.
Dangerously unqualified.
In all sorts of ways. But he also has said things in the past that would have, in a different time, in a different era, have automatically disqualified you and gotten you thrown out of the Senate. I come from a military family, and we take these things pretty seriously. He has claimed that he has smelled war. He's never been enlisted. He's never been in combat. He's never served in uniform. And yet he constantly makes references to what it's like to be in a war zone. For those of us who have smelled war, for those of us who have been in a war zone. Now, in the history of this republic, it has those kind of false statements about
stolen valor.
Stolen valor have cost you your political career in the past. This gets a pass. In this atmosphere, this gets a pass. And this, I think, is emblematic of the lack of seriousness with which this administration actually takes those kind of things.
And Senator from Michigan tried to hold him account to that and asked him a series of questions.
Then
Ron Paul eventually... That's his father. In any case, Rand Paul, they did go into a classified setting after and were ostensibly supposed to talk about it, but Senator Kelly came out of that saying it was more confusing than when they went in. So it was not cleared up.
Yeah, and it doesn't take much to realize that he's never sat on a congressional committee that would have, as part of its oversight responsibilities, been in a war zone, ever.
Right.
So these literally...
His claims made no sense.
40 years ago, this would have disqualified you on its merits from holding this position, let alone he has no qualifications to hold this position. But he's going to be confirmed.
We're going to hold right there for a second. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll finish up. I promise we'll do all of that after this. Good morning, all. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our program this morning. We have a few moments together, and we have a wonderful group this morning. Both Bob Brigham is here and Teresa Bourgeois, and we've been having a very fruitful conversation about what is going on in our world, and we thank you for your letters and your thoughtfulness as we progress this morning. Teresa, a couple points that you wanted to make.
Yeah, one of the things I think that didn't get nearly the scrutiny that it requires is these ICE detention facilities. And there's an interesting report out by the American Immigration Council. Just right now, folks, there are more than 73,000 people. 73,000 people being held in ICE detention. More than 75% of them have not been convicted of anything in the United States of America. Only a very small fraction, whether it's 5%, 4%, 7%, you read different numbers, have been convicted of violent crimes. Remember that Trump-Vance, when they were running, they said they were going to get the worst of the worst, those violent criminals. Only a fraction of them have been convicted of crimes. And some of them are being detained or Americans. Too many of them are children. Last year, this report shows a record number of people died in ICE detention. More than 32 deaths were documented. This year, they are on pace to outpace last year's rate exponentially. Six people in January alone died in detention. And I really strongly recommend people, if they're concerned about this, go to the American Immigration Council, and its new report is posted that talks about the serious problems of expanding, increasing unaccountable detention system that's being grown in this country. And there were some questions that were asked about these new immigration facilities, which Mullen said, oh, well, I'll talk with the community, we'll see. But he didn't agree to stop them, and there wasn't enough attention. And I think that this issue of why is the Trump administration building out so many? They want now more than 130,000 detention beds. And I heard an interview yesterday from somebody who was held for a lengthy period of time. And she said in the first detention center she was held in, there were no beds. She slept for more than a week on a concrete floor. Often there's not food, not clean water. People are dying because they can't get access to medicine. And this really needs so much more attention, and it didn't get it yesterday.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think Teresa summed it up, sadly, correctly.
Where's the outrage?
Yeah.
I mean, really, where you cannot say you didn't see. All of us have an obligation to be talking about this. Something has to be done about this. And the children who are being traumatized in these places, it's just horrendous.
Why do you think it didn't get, I mean, from either side, really, to get attention during, I mean, there's going to be more hearings. What I had mentioned before,
vote out of committee in the Senate? Or?
Correct, yeah. The Senate committee voted to advance the nomination of mm-hmm. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, and now it goes to the full Senate with a favorable recommendation. That's what mm-hmm. happened this morning.
So Paul voted no, and so it must be that Pennsylvania sweatshirt.
Fetterman.
Fetterman must have voted yes.
Yeah. Pennsylvania sweatshirt. But we all knew, didn't we? We all knew.
Clues, giving you, I'm still thinking about the children in detention. I just can't sleep at night over this. I don't know why. There were a number of questions. New Jersey, New Hampshire senators both asked about whether or not the communities do not want the facilities there. Mullen said, well, you know, I'm a contractor. I know about buildings. I know that you need the infrastructure, and we'll go talk to the community. We'll talk to them. We'll make sure they have what they need. And then they talked about it in the context of, I know it's taking these buildings off the tax rolls and that these communities don't want to lose the tax base. That's not the issue isn't the tax. Well, I'm sure for some it's an issue, but it's a fundamental philosophical moral issue of, do you detain Americans who have been convicted of nothing, who've had no due process, or, you know, they're non-citizens? Do you detain people who are in the process of, they might not be citizens, but they're following the legal process of becoming citizens? They get called in for a detention hearing that they go to because they've always gone to them, and then they get detained. you know, this is a moral issue, not a tax issue, she said in her ranting tone.
No.
I'm really, what are we going to do about this, folks? Speak up.
So we have just a few moments left. I'd like to talk about Jerome Powell. The article that caught my eye yesterday was this idea that
he's going to stay.
That right.
That's fabulous. I'm sorry. I went to
Trump has tried so hard to get rid of this guy. He's at the end of his term. And he'll end up staying because they don't have the replacement in line.
And the Republicans, who are going to be key to the to part of this, say that they won't confirm Warsh until this investigation. This is a trap of Trump's own making, which right. is the delight of all of this, if there is a delight in all of this, is that, you know, Trump sent Spiro on him, and now they've got to play this all out.
And so right. they're holding the nomination yeah. until it's adjudicated, and it's going to take a long time, and so it'll take long enough so that Powell can stay in that seat until the Trump-Vance administration is gone, and then the seat will go to the next administration. And isn't that lovely justice? Thank you.
Well, Powell. And just living up to my name of St. Joseph, not the aspirin.
It's a cure for headache. This is a cure for headache.
But St. Joseph wonders whether poor Powell, like he just wants to go home at this point, doesn't he? Like he
oh,
wants
no.
to go.
I think. I mean, I.
You think he's enjoying this?
Oh my goodness!
Yeah.
The picture of him and President Trump standing there in that site when they were walking through, and when Trump said that it was going to cost a whole lot
right.
more, and he pulls out the little piece of paper with his smirk and said, "Oh no, that was another building." He said, "Well, it's being built." "Oh no, that was built 5 years ago," and just the, you know.
Yeah.
It's just so bad.
Good old-fashioned eviscerating.
It was
right.
just a quiet,
right.
you know, putting him in his place. No, I think he's having fun.
All right. Well, we are out of time, my friends, and I thank you so much for being with us. Bob and Teresa, you're wonderful. It has been most fun spending time with you this morning.
Good
I thank
being
you very
with
much.
You.
I mean, as fun as it is talking yeah. about what we were talking about, but good conversation, and I thank you very much.
Appreciate the opportunity, and my thoughts for all the military families and
yes,
those who are
absolutely.
Deployed. And help your neighbors if those are your neighbors.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue hour 3 of the Roundtable right after this.